A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corn. I'm listening to the episode about how El Al, Israel's national airline, operates a somewhat unique security arrangement abroad by which, as anyone who's flown to Israel with El Al knows, you go through the this kind of additional level of screening. And I always wondered, as I said, how does that actually work in practice? Because you don't typically, you know, board, let's say, a Delta flight to the US and get questioned by TSA officials at a foreign airport. It's quite a unique arrangement, and it was a very interesting explanation as to how it's not quite the Wild West that it seems. And you pointed out correctly that the American government does operate something in Shannon Airport, which I've been through, and that's a good point. So it's not totally without precedent or parallel in the international world. I'd like to fork from that discussion about admissibility to Israel, because we talked about how airlines have an obligation for the security of their flight, and that when you're getting those questions from El Al security personnel about, as you said, what your grandmother's maiden name was, they're basically determining, are you posing a safety risk to the flight? And even though the arrangement between El Al security and the state of Israel might be very close, it's out of their purview to determine admissibility to Israel. And the concept of admissibility to Israel is in itself a complex issue because of Israel's laws by which it will deny entry to people who advocate for BDS, boycotts against Israel. Now, I have to say, I fully support that law. I think if you're going to advocate for economically isolating a country, that country shouldn't has its right under its sovereignty. This is my opinion. Not to let you in. Now, other people would say that's creating, you know, that's stifling the freedom of speech, etc. I'd love to ask about how this principle is applied broadly, because Israel is only one point. Let's say, for example, that I were extremely critical of the US government, and I'm not, by the way, but if I were, if that were my political bent, or I was very anti-France, how does that work in general? I mean, I assume it's on a case-by-case basis, but what can we point to in some commonalities in which countries are prepared to tolerate admissibility of people who are critical of its current government? And where have states drawn that limit? Because we're seeing some moves in the US towards more invasive and proactive security checks of social media, things like that. And if we might have thought that the general principle in the past was that broad criticism that wasn't overtly hateful might have been considered par for the course or not grounds to deny entry to somebody, we're seeing moves towards a more concrete application of those criteria, where some states like Israel are prepared to define very specific criteria that if you endorse BDS and it's on the public record, be warned, we're not going to let you in. We're going to turn you back. We're going to deport you. Curious to know what other states are applying similar principles, and if Israel is even a significant outlier in this respect, or if there's more states who apply principles like this than one might expect.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good fort from something we discussed a while back, the El Al security model abroad. He's asking about admissibility, the right of a sovereign state to deny entry to people who advocate for its economic or political isolation. Israel's law on BDS is the starting point, but he wants to know how this principle applies more broadly. Which countries are prepared to bar entry based on political speech or activism? Where do they draw the line, and is Israel actually an outlier here, or just more explicit about it?
By the way, today's script is coming to us courtesy of DeepSeek V4 Pro, So if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Unusually coherent from you, you mean?
I walked into that one. But this question is genuinely well-timed because the landscape has shifted a lot in the last couple of years. The instinct a decade ago was that liberal democracies don't do ideological border filtering. That's an authoritarian thing. And that framing has gotten harder to sustain.
Right, because the framing was always a bit of a convenient fiction. Every country does admissibility screening. The question is, what criteria they're willing to name out loud versus what they quietly instruct consular officers to do.
And Israel is unusual precisely because it named the criteria. The 2017 amendment to the entry into Israel law says explicitly, if you knowingly issue a public call to boycott Israel, or if you've committed to participating in a boycott and you're a representative of an organization that calls for one, you can be denied entry. It's not hidden. It's not deniable.
Which is almost jarring in its directness. Most countries prefer the ambiguity. You get denied at the border and nobody tells you why, and the official reason is something vague about documentation.
That ambiguity serves a purpose. It gives the state maximum discretion with minimum accountability. Israel's approach is the opposite. It's saying, here's the red line, you know where it is, and if you cross it, don't act surprised.
Let's map the spectrum. On one end, you've got countries that are explicit about ideological grounds for exclusion. Israel, with BDS, is the clearest example. Where else do we see that explicitness?
Saudi Arabia and several Gulf states are pretty straightforward about it. If you've been publicly critical of the royal family or the government, you're not getting a visa, the UAEE. Has deported people for social media posts made before they even arrived. But these are not liberal democracies, so they don't create the same tension.
The interesting cases are the democracies that are inching toward explicitness while maintaining the language of openness.
That's where the United States comes in, because the shift here is significant and undercovered. In June 2025, the State Department announced what it called enhanced social media vetting for visa applicants. The rule change requires applicants to provide social media handles going back 5 years across multiple platforms. And it's not just the big ones. They're asking for identifiers on platforms that are popular in specific regions, like VK for Russian applicants or WeChat for Chinese applicants.
This isn't just, let's glance at your public Twitter feed.
Not at all. The State Department estimated this affects roughly 14 million visa applicants annually. And the language of the announcement was instructive. They framed it as national security vetting, but the scope is broad enough to capture political speech that falls well short of any security threat.
What's the standard they're applying? Because that's the crux of Daniel's question. If I'm a French citizen applying for a U-Tourist visa and my Instagram is full of posts calling American foreign policy criminal, does that trigger a denial?
The public guidance doesn't say that explicitly. The stated criteria are about ties to terrorist organizations, criminal activity, national security threats. But here's what's changed. The vetting is now being done by consular officers with AI-assisted review tools and the training materials. According to a Bloomberg Law report from March this year, instruct officers to look for what they call adversarial narratives in anti-U.
That's a phrase that can do a lot of work.
It's capacious. And the worry from civil liberties groups is that it creates a chilling effect where people self-censor before applying, which is arguably the point. You don't need to deny 100,000 visas if people with critical views just stop applying.
There's a parallel here to what the UK has been doing. I remember a case that got attention in late 2024. The grandson of Nelson Mandela was denied a visa to speak at events in the UK because of his involvement in pro-Palestinian activism.
That case was striking because of the symbolic weight of the name. Zwelle Vilayel Mandela, the grandson of Nelson Mandela, was denied entry in October 2024. The UK Home Office didn't issue a detailed public explanation, but the reporting indicated it was tied to his activism around Palestinian issues. And this is the UK, which has historically positioned itself as a marketplace of ideas. The optics were terrible, and they did it anyway.
Which suggests the political cost of these denials is lower than it used to be. Governments are calculating that the domestic constituency that wants ideological filtering is larger and more motivated than the constituency that will protest it.
That's the second-order point Daniel's question gets at. It's not just about the legal framework, it's about the political realignment that makes these frameworks viable.
Let's talk about the Israeli case in more detail, because Daniel specifically flags the BDS law, and there's a recent example that illustrates how this is actually being applied. In January, a Jewish-American researcher was denied entry to Israel over what was described as anarchist activity in the West Bank.
Right, this was covered in Haaretz. The individual was a Jewish-American academic researcher. The grounds for denial weren't BDS advocacy, they were related to involvement with anarchist groups active in the West Bank, which shows that Israel's admissibility framework isn't just about the boycott law. There's a broader set of criteria around activities that are seen as undermining state security or public order.
The fact that it was a Jewish American is significant because one of the criticisms of the BDS law was that it would primarily be used against Palestinians and Arabs. This case makes clear that the net is wider.
Israel also maintains a list of organizations whose members or supporters can be denied entry. Some of these are BDS affiliated, but not all. The legal framework is layered. You've got the specific BDS amendment, you've got broader security-based exclusions, and you've got administrative discretion that doesn't always require a public rationale.
Israel is an outlier in terms of explicitness, but maybe not in terms of practice. The practice of political exclusion at the border is widespread. The difference is that Israel writes it down.
Let me give you a framework for thinking about this, because Daniel asked about commonalities. I think there are roughly three models operating right now.
All right, lay them out.
Model 1 is the explicit criteria model. Israel is the poster child. The state says publicly, these specific political activities or affiliations will get you denied. The advantage is predictability. You know the rules. The disadvantage is that it invites legal challenge and diplomatic friction. But Israel has decided those costs are worth bearing.
Who else is in that bucket?
Under the current administration is moving in that direction, though it's not fully there. The social media vetting expansion is a step toward explicit criteria, but the criteria themselves are still somewhat opaque. You could argue that certain Gulf states are in this bucket too, but again, they're not liberal democracies, so the dynamic is different. Model 2 is discretionary exclusion with plausible deniability. This is where most Western democracies sit. The UK denying Mandela's grandson, they didn't announce a new policy. They didn't say we don't admit pro-Palestinian activists. They just denied the visa and let the ambiguity do the work. France does this, Germany does this. You can be denied entry for reasons that are clearly political, but the official explanation will reference something else. Public order, documentation issues, whatever.
The advantage of Model 2 is flexibility. You can adjust based on diplomatic sensitivities. Deny a Russian dissident? Probably not worth the backlash. Deny a Palestinian activist? The domestic political cost is manageable.
And Model 3 is the least common but worth mentioning, the statutory hostility model. This is where a country has laws on the books that don't just deny entry to specific individuals, but create a legal environment where certain political positions are inherently grounds for exclusion or even criminal liability upon entry.
Give me an example.
Turkey is probably the clearest case. If you've publicly criticized the Turkish government, or, critically, if you've used social media to comment on certain historical events in ways the state considers insulting to Turkishness, there are legal provisions that can make you inadmissible or even subject to arrest upon arrival. The same applies to several other countries with laws against insulting the head of state or the national identity. So you're not just denied entry, you could face legal jeopardy if you enter.
That's a different order of risk. With Israel, the consequence of BDS advocacy is that you're turned back at the airport. You're not prosecuted for the speech itself.
And that distinction matters. Israel's law is an immigration control measure, not a criminal speech code. The speech is legal. You can say whatever you want about Israel from outside Israel. The state is just saying it won't facilitate your entry while you're advocating for its economic destruction. That's a sovereignty argument, not a censorship argument.
Which is why Daniel's framing of it as a sovereignty question is the right one. The people who frame it as a free speech issue are missing the category. You have a right to speak. You don't have a right to enter a foreign country.
This is where the U social media vetting creates an interesting tension, because the U has the First Amendment, which is more protective of speech than almost any other legal framework in the world. The question that's being litigated right now, and I don't think we have a clear answer yet, is whether visa denial based on political speech violates the First Amendment when the speech is fully protected for citizens.
The traditional answer has been no, because non-citizens outside the EU don't have First Amendment rights, but that's being tested.
It's being tested in a few ways. One is the doctrine of consular non-reviewability, which has historically meant that visa decisions by consular officers are essentially unreviewable by courts. But there are cases working their way through the system that challenge whether that doctrine can shield decisions that are explicitly based on political viewpoint.
The AI angle here is new. If an algorithm is flagging applicants based on keyword analysis of their social media, and the algorithm is trained on data that reflects political biases, you've introduced a new layer of legal vulnerability.
That's exactly what the ACLU and other groups have been arguing. The Bloomberg Law piece from March noted that the training data and the specific indicators consular officers are being asked to look for have not been made public. So you've got a black box system making recommendations about who's an adversarial narrative, risk, and the human officer is essentially rubber stamping.
Which is a due process nightmare if you're on the receiving end.
Practically, there's no appeal. If a visa is denied on these grounds, you might not even be told that social media review was the basis. You just get a denial.
Let's pull back to the broader question Daniel raised. Are more states applying principles like this than one might expect? I think the answer is clearly yes, but the mechanisms differ.
The trend line is toward more explicitness, not less. 10 years ago, the idea that the EU would be systematically reviewing social media for visa applicants would have been controversial in a way that generated sustained opposition. Now it's policy, and the opposition is there, but it's not blocking implementation.
Part of what's driving this is the collapse of the distinction between security vetting and political vetting. The argument is always framed as security. We need to know who's entering the country. But the definition of security has expanded to include ideological alignment.
This is where Israel's explicitness is almost clarifying. By saying, we exclude BDS advocates because they seek to harm the state economically, Israel is making an argument that many other countries are making implicitly, that economic or political hostility is a legitimate grounds for exclusion, even if the individual poses no physical threat.
Let's talk about some other examples that don't get as much attention. Australia has a character test in its migration law that allows the government to deny visas to people whose presence might incite discord or represent a danger to the Australian community. That language has been used to deny visas to people for political speech.
Australia has been pretty open about using it. They've denied visas to several high-profile speakers over the years, people whose views were controversial but not criminal. The mechanism is administrative, not legislative, which gives the government a lot of flexibility.
Canada has something similar with its immigration inadmissibility provisions. If you're deemed to be a member of an organization that has engaged in what the government considers terrorism, you can be excluded. The definition of terrorism has been broad enough to capture some political organizations.
That's the trick. You don't need to ban political speech. You just define certain political organizations as security threats, and then you exclude their members on security grounds. The result is the same, but the framing avoids the free speech problem.
India is another interesting case. They've denied entry to foreign journalists and activists who've been critical of government policies, particularly around Kashmir. The official reasons vary, but the pattern is clear enough that it's been noted by press freedom organizations.
The Modi government has been fairly explicit about it in some cases. They've revoked visas for people already in the country, which is a different level of assertion. It's not just border control. It's saying your presence here is no longer welcome because of your speech or activities.
Which brings up the distinction between denying entry and deporting. Daniel mentioned deportation. Most of what we're talking about is denial of entry. Deportation of someone already lawfully present raises a different set of legal questions.
Though it happens. Has deported foreign nationals for political activities, particularly during periods of heightened security concern. The legal basis is usually a visa violation rather than the political activity itself, but the enforcement is clearly targeted.
If we're constructing a map of approaches, it's not really a binary of Israel versus everyone else. It's a spectrum. Israel is at one end in terms of explicitness and specificity, is moving toward more systematic vetting but still using security language. The UK and Australia and Canada use broad discretionary powers. Turkey and similar states have criminal law backing their exclusions.
I'd add the European Union dimension, because the Schengen area complicates this. Individual member states can flag people in the Schengen information system, which then affects entry across the whole zone. So a denial by one country effectively becomes a denial by 27.
Which creates an interesting dynamic where countries with stricter political exclusion criteria can effectively export those criteria to the rest of the zone.
If Hungary decides that certain types of political activism are grounds for exclusion and they enter that into the SIS, someone flying into Paris could be denied based on Hungary's determination. The French border officer might not even know the specific reason. They just see the flag.
That's a sovereignty problem that hasn't been fully worked out.
It's one of the tensions in the Schengen system that gets very little public discussion. The assumption was always that member states would use SIS flags for genuine security threats, not political filtering. But as the definition of security expands, so does the use of the system.
Let's go back to Daniel's specific point about BDS and Israel, because I think there's a nuance here that's worth drawing out. The BDS movement is not just criticism of Israeli policy. It's a campaign for economic, cultural, and academic boycotts aimed at isolating the country. That's different from saying I disagree with the current government's approach to settlements.
That distinction matters for the sovereignty argument. A state denying entry to people who advocate for its economic destruction is operating on a different principle than a state denying entry to people who criticize its tax policy. The question is where you draw the line, and Israel has drawn it at organized boycott advocacy, not at criticism generally.
Which is why the free speech counterargument doesn't fully land. Israel isn't saying you can't criticize it. It's saying you can't lead a campaign to economically strangle it and then expect to be welcomed as a visitor.
This is where the U example is instructive in a different way, has laws on the books that prohibit participation in boycotts against countries friendly to the U, the anti-boycott provisions of the Export Administration Act. These are directed at the Arab League boycott of Israel. So the U itself has a legal framework that treats certain boycott participation as problematic.
Though those laws regulate commercial activity by U persons, not entry by foreign nationals.
Correct, but the principle that boycott participation can be a legitimate subject of state concern is shared, just operationalizes it differently.
What about the argument that these laws are counterproductive? That denying entry to BDS advocates gives them a platform and validates their narrative?
That's an empirical question, and I don't think we have good data either way. Israel's calculation seems to be that the symbolic cost of admitting people who are actively working to delegitimize the state is higher than the PR cost of excluding them. Whether that's correct is debatable, but it's a coherent position.
It's worth noting that the law has been applied sparingly. It's not like every person who's ever liked a BDS Facebook post is being turned away. The high-profile cases tend to involve organizational leaders or people whose entry would create a specific controversy.
The January case of the Jewish American researcher is a good example. That wasn't a BDS case. It was about activities in the West Bank. But it shows that the admissibility framework is being actively used, and not just against the most obvious targets.
If we're answering Daniel's question directly, is Israel a significant outlier? I'd say it's an outlier in transparency, not in practice. The practice of political exclusion at the border is common. What's unusual is writing the criteria into law and being willing to defend them publicly.
I think the trend is toward more countries adopting something closer to the Israeli model of explicitness, even if they're not there yet. Social media vetting is a step in that direction. The UK's willingness to deny high-profile figures is another. The question is whether the transparency catches up with the practice.
One concern I have about the trend toward explicitness is that it can create a ratchet effect. Once you've named a category of excludable speech, there's pressure to expand it. BDS today, what tomorrow? Criticism of specific policies, association with certain organizations.
That's a legitimate concern, and it's why the specificity of the Israeli law matters. It's not a general criticism of Israel exclusion. It's tied to active participation in boycott advocacy. The line is bright enough that you can see it.
The West Bank activist case suggests the line is blurrier in practice.
And that's the tension in any admissibility framework. The written criteria are one thing. How they're applied is another.
Let's talk about the practical experience Daniel mentioned. Going through Shannon Airport, which has you. That's an interesting parallel to the LAO model.
Shannon is one of the few airports outside the U where you go through U customs and border protection before you board, so you're effectively on U soil, legally speaking, while still in Ireland. The CBP officers there have the same authority to question you and deny boarding that they would have at JFK.
They're making admissibility determinations based on you. So if the U decides that certain political affiliations make you inadmissible, that determination happens in Shannon just as it would in New York.
Which brings us back to the LAO model in an interesting way. The commonality is that the screening happens before you board, at the departure airport, based on the destination country's criteria. The difference is that LAO security is airline operated with close state coordination, while CBP preclearance is directly state operated.
The legal basis is different. LAO is operating under Israeli law and bilateral agreements. CBP is operating under U law and specific preclearance treaties.
The practical experience for the passenger is similar. You get questioned before you board. If you don't pass, you don't fly. The airline has an interest in not transporting you because they'd have to bring you back if you denied entry on arrival.
Which is why airlines in general do some level of admissibility screening, even without a formal pre-clearance arrangement. If you show up at the gate for a flight to a country that requires a visa, the gate agent checks your passport. They're not making an admissibility determination, but they're verifying that you have the documentation that suggests you'll be admitted.
That's the baseline. LAO goes beyond that baseline because of the specific security context. The questioning about your grandmother's maiden name and the purpose of your visit, that's not standard airline practice. That's a security layer that most carriers don't have.
Daniel's point about this not being the Wild West is important. These arrangements are negotiated. They're in bilateral agreements. The host country has to consent to foreign security personnel operating on its soil.
That consent can be withdrawn. If a country decides that LAO security procedures are too intrusive or that they violate local laws, they can say no. The fact that these arrangements persist suggests that host countries see value in them, either because they enhance security or because they reduce the risk of incidents that would create diplomatic problems.
Where does this leave us? I think Daniel's question about commonalities is well answered by the three-model framework you laid out. Most countries are doing some version of political admissibility filtering. The differences are in transparency, specificity, and the legal mechanisms used.
The trend is toward more filtering, more systematically applied, with more technological tools. The AI-assisted social media review that the U is doing now, that's going to become standard practice for a lot of countries over the next decade.
Which raises questions that I don't think we have good answers to yet. What happens when an algorithm trained on U's security priorities is used to screen applicants from countries with very different political cultures? What's the false positive rate? Who audits the system?
Those are the right questions. And right now, the answer to most of them is, we don't know, and the information isn't public. The Bloomberg Law reporting suggested that even some consular officers are uncomfortable with the opacity of the new system.
That's not reassuring.
No, it's not, and that's why the Israeli model of explicitness, whatever you think of the policy itself, has a certain structural advantage. You know what the rule is, you can plan around it. The discretion is bounded.
Though, as we discussed, the West Bank activist case suggests the boundary is permeable.
And that's a tension Israel will have to manage. The more you use broad security rationales alongside specific statutory criteria, the more the predictability of the system erodes.
I want to return to something Daniel said in his prompt, that he fully supports the BDS exclusion law. His reasoning is that if you advocate for economically isolating a country, that country has the sovereign right to not let you in. I think that's right, as a matter of principle.
And I think it's a principle that most people accept when they think about it in the abstract. The controversy arises when you apply it to a specific case that people have strong feelings about.
That's always how it works. The principle is easy. The application is where it gets uncomfortable.
That discomfort is the whole ballgame. The question isn't whether states have the right to exclude. They do. The question is whether they exercise that right in ways that are consistent, predictable, and tied to genuine state interests rather than political convenience.
On that score, I think the record is mixed across the board. Every country we've discussed has cases where the exclusion looks principled and cases where it looks political. The challenge is designing a system that minimizes the latter.
That's a design problem that very few countries have seriously engaged with. Israel's BDS law is an attempt at a bright-line rule. Social media vetting is an attempt at systematic risk assessment. Both have flaws, but they're at least attempts to bring some structure to a process that is otherwise pure administrative discretion.
The alternative is the UK model. Deny the visa, say as little as possible, and let the ambiguity absorb the criticism. That's politically easier in the short term, but does nothing for the rule of law.
It creates a system where outcomes depend on which consular officer you get, which is not justice in any meaningful sense.
To answer Daniel directly, Israel is not as much of an outlier as it might appear. The practice of political admissibility filtering is widespread. What distinguishes Israel is the willingness to name the criteria and defend them in public. And the trend globally is toward more systematic filtering, which makes the Israeli approach look less exceptional over time.
I'd add one caveat. The Israeli approach works in part because Israel is a small country with a very specific security context. Scaling that model to a country the size of the United States, with vastly more visa applicants and a much broader range of political contexts, is a hard problem. The AI-assisted vetting is an attempt to solve that scaling problem, and we don't know yet whether it works or what the costs are.
That's a good place to leave it. The principle is clear. The implementation is messy, and the technology is changing faster than the law. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, sailors in the Solomon Islands reported a strange red dust falling from the sky that coated ships and turned rainwater the color of rust. Modern analysis of similar events shows that a single dust storm in Australia's interior can lift enough fine sediment to blanket an area the size of New Zealand, roughly 100,000 square miles, and the dust that fell on those sailors had traveled over 2,000 miles across the Coral Sea in about 4 days. Which means those particles were moving at an average speed of over 20 miles per hour for nearly 100 hours straight.
20 miles an hour. Dust.
I'm going to need a moment with that one.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumintop for the fact and for keeping the show running. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.